This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse was done on July 12th of 2005. It contains John's commentary and the discussion session about Chapter 6 of People's History, called The Intimately Oppressed. The LA Sound Posse records and publishes anti-copyrighted talks and events such as this and can be reached at lasoundposse.org. The contact information will be repeated at the end of the recording.
Our focus tonight is the intimately oppressed, or as the English feminist Juliette Mitchell called it, the longest revolution. Women have essentially been invisible in U.S. history, not just in U.S. history, of course, but that's what we're going to be focusing on, even though my comments will draw from other areas. This has been justified by the argument that biology is destiny. And if you recall our previous discussions on American Indians and Africans and African Americans, just women connected to biology as destiny, just as oppressed racial minorities have been tied to biology and nature. That is, where physical characteristics are used to deny historical power relations created and sustained by men of power, not nature. Oppression, Zinn is arguing very clearly, the oppression has nothing to do with nature, it has to do with society, it has to do with culture. Women have been kept in their place by ideological means, such as the Bible, the religious messages in the Bible and the Christian and other traditions, through tradition in this country, but also through sexual abuse and violence. Because I will argue that behind the velvet glove of ideas lies the iron fist of violence. And I would make the same argument in terms of the racist oppression in the United States toward indigenous peoples and African Americans. And that the violence and oppression visited upon women crosses all class, cultural, and ethnic boundaries. It's trans-historical, and it has been deeply, deeply rooted in the entire history of this country. At the same time, as you see from Zinn's discussion, women have resisted their oppression despite facing special disabilities and living right underneath the eyes and with those who have often been their oppressors. This resistance became formally organized in the mid-19th century with the rise of the women's suffrage movement, and we'll get to that. Thomas Jefferson's phrase in the Declaration of Independence that, quote, all men are created equal, meant just that. Women had no formal political power at that time, and in the terms of the federal level, women had no formal political power until they gained, after a long struggle, the right to vote in 1920. The women had the right to vote in certain states prior to that time. This suffrage was gained over decades of agitation and organization and never given as a gift by male authorities. Recall the quote I shared with you from Frederick Douglass about change and struggle, that those in power never accede to change without a struggle, and his quote applies very, very well to the feminist movement and the struggle by women generally to gain equality in the United States. An early feminist challenge to gender inequality, Zinn discusses this, came from Mary Wollstonecraft in England, the mother of Mary Shelley, who was the author who was to write Frankenstein. Wollstonecraft's brilliant critique of male supremacy is found in her major work, A Vindication of the Rights of Women, which was published in 1792. She opposed the state of ignorance and servility to which women were condemned by social custom and training. She argued, and I quote, "Women are told from their infancy and taught by the example of their mothers that a little knowledge of human weakness, just termed cunning, softness of temper, outward appearance, and a scrupulous attention to a puerile kind of propriety will obtain for them the protection of man." She said that my objection extends to the entire purport of those books on women which tend to degrade one half of the human species and render women pleasing at the expense of every solid virtue. She harshly criticized the influential male philosophers and writers of her time who asserted that female education ought to be directed to one point, to render them pleasing. And I quote again from Wollstonecraft, "I lament that women are systematically degraded by receiving the trivial attentions which men think it manly to pay to their sex when in fact they are insultingly supporting their own superiority." Zinn and others have argued that we must try to understand the gender power relations discussed by Wollstonecraft, both historically and theoretically. For example, the contemporary feminist poet and writer Adrienne Rich argues that since all human life on the planet is born of woman, most of us first know love and disappointment, power and tenderness in the person of a woman. We carry that imprint of this experience for life. She argues that there is much to suggest that males have been haunted by the force of this idea of dependence on a woman for life itself. Women have provided continuity and stability, but also the rejections and refusals of our early lives. And it is with a woman's hands, eyes, body, voice, that we associate our primal sensations, our earliest social experience. Two fundamental ideas come down to us in the United States and other societies as well, especially in the Christian West, that have been influenced by the Bible and that have profoundly shaped our conceptions of gender in Western history. On one hand, females are impure and corrupt, and on the other hand, they are beneficent, sacred, pure, asexual, and nourishing. A number of feminists have argued that maternity and sexuality have been channeled to serve these bipolar, conflicting views and for male interests, and that behavior by women that threatens this foundation and patriarchal institutions is considered deviant or criminal. Mothers bear in the Christian West the weight of Eve's transgression, eating from the forbidden tree of knowledge. We're all familiar with that story. But the social theorist and refugee from German fascism, Erich Fromm, wrote some years ago that Eve's act of rebellion was the first step toward human liberation and freedom in history. Most of us, all of us, especially in the US, in one way or another, were taught or learned, however, that she was the first offender, the polluted one who disobeyed God and therefore disobeyed men. Religion, therefore, has been very, very critical in justifying women's oppression, as with American Indians and with slaves. And the Bible offers ample support for misogyny, the hatred of women. Josephine Henry, a leading 19th century suffragist, castigated the churches for their consistently sexist attitude over the century. She stated, "Has the church ever issued an edict that women must have equal rights with men before the canon or civil law? No institution in modern civilization is so tyrannical and so unjust to women as is the Christian church. It demands everything from her and gives nothing in return. The history of the church does not contain a single suggestion for the equality of women. Through tyranny and falsehood alone is Christianity able to hold women in subjection." Or as perhaps the greatest 19th century agnostic orator in the United States, Colonel Robert Ingersoll, stated, "As long as women regard the Bible as the charter of their rights, they will be the slave of man. When Elizabeth Cady Stanton, in the middle of the 19th century, asserted about religion, remains with us. Quote, "The Bible and the church have been the greatest stumbling blocks to women's emancipation. The Bible was used to support women's oppression, and Christian men used it to keep women silent, submissive, and uneducated for centuries. Challenges to this worldview have come from those who opposed such oppression." And of course it has been opposed, especially since the rise of the suffragist movement in the middle of the 19th century in the United States. These women in turn, and their few male allies, were vilified for raising such objections and opposed by every leading religious and political institution in the society. The inferior status of women is built upon a biblical misogyny in which the ideal is the submissive woman. The Bible, leading theologians, and over the centuries the Roman Catholic Church shaped the dominant patriarchal thinking. Quote, "Wives, submit yourselves to your husband as unto the Lord. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their husbands in everything." It's from Ephesians. Quote, "The head of every man is Christ, and the head of every woman is man." Corinthians. St. Thomas Aquinas, "Woman is defective and misbegotten." And last but not least, the virulently anti-Semitic Martin Luther, quote, "God created Adam Lord of all living creatures, but Eve spoiled it all. If a woman grows weary and dies from childbearing, it matters not." In the Middle Ages, untold thousands and thousands of women were condemned as witches by the church during the Inquisition and burned at the stake, drawing from the line in Exodus, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." These victims were often women who were midwives and healers who challenged the power and authority of men and the church. When the Grimke sisters, who were both abolitionists and feminists, spoke at anti-slavery conventions in the 1830s, they broke a public and religious convention in the United States that forbade women to appear on public platforms. A pastoral letter from the Congregational Church, they were Southerners, by the way, they were from South Carolina as well. A pastoral letter from the Congregational Church was issued against them. Quote, "When a woman assumes the place and tone of a man as a public reformer, she yields the power which God has given her for her protection, and her character becomes unnatural." But this did not stop Sarah Grimke, who stated, quote, "that all history attests that man has subjected women to his will, used her as a means to promote his selfish gratification, to minister to his sensual pleasures, to be instrumental in promoting his comfort, but never has he desired to elevate her to that rank she was created to fill. Women, instead of being elevated by her union with man, generally loses her individuality, her independent character and moral being. She becomes absorbed into him and henceforth is looked at and acts through the medium of her husband. As with racism and slavery, therefore, and other forms of oppression that we see and deal with all the time today, religious ideas have been used to keep an oppressive system in place as a way of blocking the oppressed group from challenging and changing it. Recalling Frederick Douglass's quote on agitation and change, "Without resistance from women, without a suffrage movement, without a feminist movement, we would still be following the Congregational Church's view in this country." Zinn spends a little time talking about another period in the 19th century, that is the rise of industrial capitalism, especially in the northeastern United States, which brought with it the rise of what historians called the cult of true womanhood or femininity. This was popularized through the new ladies' magazines and romance novels, though it was profoundly class and racial based. It was aimed at white women who are more privileged and who were seen as the inhabitants of a sphere totally severed and separate from the realm of productive work. As the factory system emerges, the home becomes known as the haven in the heartless world. Of course, this sphere and this ideology does not apply to black women, free or slaves, or poor immigrants. Men would go into the world while their women would make a lovely place in the home. The cleavage between the home and work, therefore, that was brought on by industrial capitalism in a very powerful way enhanced the notion of female inferiority more than ever as women became synonymous with mother and housewife. The Haven in the Heartless World thesis revealed a hard world as industrial capitalism unfolded in the nation, with the home seen at least for the more affluent classes as a utopian and protected environment. The cult of true womanhood was an attempt to influence women to accept their separate but supposedly equal role in society. But of course, we don't have to read Zinn to know that it was never equal, as women could not vote, could not own property, could not obtain similar pay to men, and were excluded from the professions of law and medicine and from colleges and the ministry. As historian Angela Davis points out, the cult of true womanhood in the 19th century did not extend to slaves, who were inherently vulnerable to all forms of sexual coercion. The special abuse of women facilitated the ruthless exploitation of their labor. The ideology of femininity for white middle-class women did not apply to black women, who were certainly not too feminine to work in coal mines, iron foundries, as lumberjacks, ditch diggers, or railroad workers, as many of the southern railroads were built using female slave labor. Despite the middle-class image of the Haven, however, from the earliest settled life until the rise of factories as the center of production, the home, certainly in colonial and then U.S. of A., was not a refuge, was not a place for leisure and retreat from the cruelty of the outside world. And that doesn't just apply to the United States, of course. It has always been a part of the world, a center of work, a subsistence unit. This changed, however, in very profound ways with the rise of industrial capitalism that brought crucial changes in Western assumptions about the home, about work, about women, and about women's relationship to productivity, as increasingly only men would be seen as doing productive and paid work outside the home, even though increasingly and slowly women also did paid and productive work outside the home. The harsh reality faced by the wives of working class men, for example, contradicted the ideal of the home as a protected place apart from the brutal conditions of the workplace. For example, in the 19th and early 20th century, poor women had many children with several miscarriages, most of them with no prenatal care and inadequate diet. Their anxiety and physical depletion from childbearing and rearing was legion, and many took drugs to bring on abortions against their principles and their husbands' opposition. Zinn also discusses the great event in terms of this issue that shaped the 19th century, perhaps in the history of the United States, the most important political meeting in this country. That is the Women's Rights Convention in July 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York, 40 or 50 miles from where I used to live. And I've been at the Women's Hall of Fame, I've been at Elizabeth Cady Stanton's house in Seneca Falls, and in nearby Auburn, New York, is the home of Harriet Tubman. That meeting was organized by Stanton and by Lucretia Mott. 1848, revolutions in Europe, a year of incredible change throughout Europe the same year that Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto. 300 people attended that convention in Seneca Falls, but James Mott, Lucretia's husband, had to chair it since no woman dared chair such a meeting at that time. Mott and Stanton deliberately used the Declaration of Independence as a guide to forge the Declaration of Sentiments that emerged from that historic meeting. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman." 11 resolutions on women's issues were passed unanimously at that meeting, but the 12th, which was about granting women the right to vote, passed only by a narrow margin. After the great African-American abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who was the only black person in attendance, defended it from the floor. In an editorial in his paper, The North Star, in Rochester, New York, shortly after the meeting, Douglass supported the women's struggle for the vote. And I quote, "We are free to say that in regard to political rights, we hold women to be justly entitled to all that we claim for man. All political rights which are expedient for man to exercise are equally so for women. All that distinguishes man as an intelligent and accountable being is equally true of woman. Our doctrine is that right is of no sex." That reality, however, has not been the reality that has dominated this society, as the writer Kate Millett argued about 30 years ago in her very powerful book, Sexual Politics, when she asserted at that time, and I would argue that it continues, that this society is and has been essentially and fundamentally patriarchal because men control the economy, the state and its agents, and the military, and have a monopoly on sexual violence. Patriarchy penetrates class divisions and different societies. It cuts through all of those. Men establish their power and maintain control in all societies, and all social groups within this are therefore sexist in the sense that their fundamental organization at every level is predicated on the domination of one sex by the other. While ideology or ideas from the Bible and other sources have been absolutely critical in reproducing power relationships, the power relationships of patriarchy, ultimately, these ideas reflect actual physical power. And behind the ideas has been, since the beginning of the colonial period, it didn't start, of course, with the United States, but this is the one we have to understand, that the level of violence against females has been staggering and remains staggering to this day, especially when we realize that most attacks on women are not reported. A couple of years ago, for an op-ed piece, I did some research, and I recall it was a long article in the LA Times, and there's an absolute voluminous literature on this, but there was an article in the LA Times citing some data from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, which estimated at that time, this was 2001, that 4.9 million women in the United States were raped and physically assaulted by intimate partners. 4.9 million, and that is an undercount. This was for the year 2001, just in that year. This is a far greater figure than the FBI stats. And that, I did a little calculation, that was roughly 94,000 per week in the United States, and Then I calculated it roughly with the population of Los Angeles County, which that brought it down to 2,600 assaults per week. And then in Santa Monica, it's a little less than 1% of the population of the county. That's roughly 26 a week. If this level of assault, I want to make an argument that we discussed when I quoted from David Stannard's work on the American Holocaust, if this level of assault and violence was carried out on any other socially identified group in this society, for example, blacks, Jews, priests, corporate CEOs, members of Congress, there would be an outrage and action that would be staggering. But it has not been forthcoming in this society because, as David Stannard argued with American Indians, we rank the victims of violence, and women as a group are not worthy victims, despite all of the individual stories that we hear and that clearly we identify with. And I've not been able to find out in looking at FBI reports and other data to what extent the percentage of mere assaults, what percentage of those are reported. Katha Pollitt, writer for The Nation magazine, suggests that responses to such violence in this society often include routine expressions of shock and focus on the behavior of the victim. However, she believes that we must stop thinking of male violence as some kind of freak of nature, like a tornado, that actually it's quite common and ordinary. It's as American as apple pie, and it has been deeply rooted in the soil of this society since the beginning. And I would suggest, drawing off of Zinn, Pollitt, and others, that this outrage, this being the physical expression of the deep-seated misogyny that is in every single institution in this society, that this outrage will not end until, one, there's an awareness of the root causes of patriarchy and terror. Where does this come from? How did it develop? And then, two, with that analysis, agitation and organization to end both. Because as we've seen with regard to every other issue we've discussed, and our knowledge of American history is, and the history of other societies is certainly ample enough to know that nothing worthwhile ever changes without a struggle and without those in power being confronted, whether they be slave owners or patriarchal masters. Okay, let's take a break. Let's talk about this chapter, about women, about patriarchy, and your thoughts, your arguments.
I'm going to start with a little dot of dance history. I had a student at University of Wisconsin who studied 80 versions of the waltz, starting when it started in the 1860s, and then came far into the 20th century, and she looked at all the recorded versions of it. There are lots of waltzes. But right during the time when women got the vote, early part of the 20th century, there was a distinct change in the way the waltz began. Instead of the man stepping forward and the woman stepping back, they both stepped sideways.
Wow. So what did this person who did this study...
Well, she never finished. She got happily married and went off to stop being a scholar, which is regrettable because she was so thorough. But we have evidences in popular culture of this slow change. I was talking with a folk dance expert yesterday who teaches high school kids, and we were talking about how you can read culture, equality, inequality in those kinds of artifacts. I don't know whether it starts us here, but it's this subservience up and superiority that's built in all over has a little bit changed.
And the argument would be that in every cultural aspect of this and other society, the social relationships of gender are found in the home, outside the home, dancing, movies, schools. It doesn't have to be programmed. We just
even the recent, I guess it was last year, the Disney, I think it was a Disney animated feature with about horses called Spirit. They've been having women tame the men and be the leaders and be the smart ones now for a couple of years. There are a lot of, it's even in cartoons that women are finally being recognized as smart and equal and effective and maybe to be listened to, even Disney.
And the argument would be from Zinn that without a woman's movement, we were talking about textbooks during the break, without the woman's movement, let's say the most powerful part of which emerged in the mid-19th century, without that movement, which then quieted down a bit, then this resurgence in the early part of the century to the vote, then quieted down again, and then surged up again, especially after World War II. It didn't start in 1963 with Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, though that had a great impact. Without all of that agitation, nothing changes. The movies don't change, the textbooks don't change, the TV shows don't change. You know, Barbra Streisand doesn't get the direct films, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that, all of those changes for the better, we owe to the millions of women, some famous, most not, who work over decades and decades and generations to bring about the change.
Does anyone have any insight about all the ads you hear and see today in which men are just bashed? Men are, you know, portrayed as being total idiots with smart wives.
On television?
Television. Well, I don't watch television anymore, but on the radio, radio ads are like that a lot. The husband is the one, always the one who's going, duh, what do you mean? And the wife is saying, well, honey, you know, explaining garage doors to him or something like that, you know.
There's actually a line of children's clothing for young, for females that is male bashing. Has anybody read about that?
No.
Yeah.
Well, is it, Eva, is it male bashing? It's interesting. I mean, think of the ironies in the ads. I mean, I only listen to music on radio and KPFK, of course, and do watch ads on television. The ironies of, let's say, the men supposedly, we're stupid, we don't know about garage doors, we don't, of course, know how to clean floors or do clothes, and yet, in terms of all the people who, almost all the people who build garage doors, who own garage door companies, etc., they're all men. So the women in the ads are smarter, but it doesn't translate into. And I'm wondering whether it's an interesting playoff on almost flipping the roles. You know?
It really baffles me, and it's extremely insulting to men, and I'd rather see some kind of equality.
So ads are geared to women more and more. Product aimed at a home will be geared towards women, even though they know that the power's in men. It's just ads, that's all.
Right. Yeah. But of course, increasingly, every decade after decade, increasingly women, quote unquote, are not in the home. Women are in the paid labor force, not something, again, that emerged in the last 20 or 30 years. But again, when you watch almost all the ads, that's right. Who's doing what in the home, and how many times do the kids come in and absolutely mess this floor, and this woman gets this Swiffer? But they come in and they clean the, you know, they mess the floor up, and of course she smiles rather than grabbing them by the scruff of their necks and having them clean the floor. Some years ago, a number, maybe 30 years ago, Marlo Thomas put out a recording. Carol Channing is in it, and they're doing things about boys and girls. And Carol Channing, in that inimitable voice of hers, saying, now remember, kids, the woman on, she's just an actor on TV, about getting kids to think about things. And a number of people argue that we've actually gone backwards over the last 30 years with some of the TV shows and ads, that there are things objectifying women today on national television that you couldn't have even imagined in the bad old 1960s.
We were talking about shows like Extreme Makeover and The Swan, where women's images are their body and their sexuality and their beauty and not very much about their brain. Right. But you mentioned peaks and valleys in women's movements, and I'm wondering what you feel is happening now. I mean, my feeling is that when I talk to my nieces, there's very little involved in the feminist movement or women's rights and have no conscience of what went on. Like Annie and I were talking about, I used to represent Gloria Steinem and a bunch of, you know, women that writers, and we went on a lot of those feminist marches and all of that that, you know, went on at that period, where young women today don't seem to have an understanding of it, an interest in it, nor a feeling that they should do anything more.
It's been a few years since I've been in the classroom, but my sense when I finished 4 years ago, and this was teaching college, predominantly young women in my classes, mostly in an education program, but also in other departments, is that they, of course, had no problem utilizing the changes that had occurred, getting right. credit, et cetera, but would absolutely be mortified at the idea of being called a feminist. And when I try to explain, essentially it means, you know, that if you're a feminist, you really believe in equality. I mean, that's what the essence of that term. And the image many of them got in the mass media was a distorted image.
Right.
And yet they have opportunities that their mothers did not have, and certainly their grandmothers and their great-grandmothers did not have, in that all of the progressive things that have happened are built on the shoulders of others. And my sense is that even though there have been, I mean, you know, one of the largest public marches in the history of the country was, what, last April or the April mm-hmm. before in yeah. Washington, there have been massive demonstrations and continued efforts around the country. And the gains that many women have made, despite all the rhetoric of the right wing, are not going to be changed, despite all the all the arguments that, well, women should go back into the home, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the people who run the country are not going to have that happen because they want to make sure to have women's cheaper labor. But it seems that there's certainly not the anger and fire that there was right. 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Even though the issues are all there. But internationally, I was listening to someone on KPFK the other morning, I did not catch her name, internationally around issues of violence against women, around issues of the environment, political violence, et cetera, there is a growing and powerful international women's movement from India, countries in Africa, Latin America, South America, rather. That's happening. There's no doubt about that.
What do you feel about the demographics of, like, the voting demographics that are going on? Because it seems to me that any woman who can vote for anybody, that would be, again, you know, to repeal Roe versus Wade. I don't understand that at all.
Well, let's...
John.
Let's get back. Go ahead and say what you need to say, but let's get back to that issue, because that issue is very germane to what's happening in the country now.
Yeah, John, I'm wondering if you could speak to a couple of issues, one of them co-optation and the other narrowing of the consciousness. I think it was interesting that you made, and you reiterated what Zinn said about the relationship of industrial capitalism to a change in the status of women. And what is one to make of women, say, who don't, well, in terms of the narrowing of the consciousness, the irksome tendency of certain groups to call themselves feminist simply because there's a woman involved someplace and somehow, and still find themselves, for example, in favor of every capitalist, imperialist tendency you want to name, in support of the war. You also find this with gay groups, for example, the Log Cabin Republicans, which is a very bizarre group of people from my point of view, but not from theirs at all. And it seems, you know, when we read books like What's the Matter with Kansas, and we see that this social engineering has started really from 30 years ago, from the end of the anti-war movement, the Vietnam anti-war movement, this dismantling of a kind of unified consciousness, a connected consciousness, one that relates women's rights and women's liberation to other larger issues, as you've said, that women do internationally. It doesn't seem to be happening here, and it seems, in fact, there seem to be tendencies in the other direction, and I wonder if you would speak to that.
Well, I mean, I used it in the singular, the woman's movement, the feminist movement, but within that, of course, there are, as in any other movement, because women reflect the same contradictions and concerns in the society as men, that among the number of women in this society, a slight majority of those in our population, we're about 290 million, so perhaps 150 million females, I don't know how many of those, let's say, would be of voting age, broken down by class, by race, by sexual orientation, and even within those groups, clear differences. I mean, there are women who, African American and white women, who think it's absolutely peachy keen that Condoleezza Rice is the Secretary of State. There are other women, such as Angela Davis, Alice Walker, who would say that she's a mouthpiece, not only for men in power, but for the most barbaric kinds of things. And it's irrelevant that she's a woman. It's irrelevant that she is African American. They would make the same argument about Madeleine Albright, by the way. This is not a Republican issue. So within the overall framework of women struggling for equality, it breaks down ideologically like every other group. And we can't make a caricature out of the feminist movement. There have been deep strains and tensions within the feminist movement. The more separatist, radical feminists, especially emerging out of the late 60s and early 70s, there have been those who feel that great strides are made because more women are elected to office, that the idea it makes no difference that the two senators in California are female, I think is not an argument that one can make. You have to make an argument on the basis of their actual politics, though neither one of them or Hillary Clinton, that rad lib, et cetera, as she's called in the country, none of them, I'm sure, would use the term feminist to designate their own politics. I think the whole debate has shifted to the right in the country on that matter. So there are struggles within, and there were in the suffragette movement in the 1840s and 50s that led to a split between people like Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass and others, when, for example, some women supported the Reconstruction Amendments granting the vote to black men, not women, not black women. That led to a split in the women's movement at that time. And those things are going to continue on economic issues, on issues of war and peace, on issues of minimum wage, on issues of childbearing, on the whole issue of Roe v. Wade, which is an issue that is going to be revisited, that you should follow the papers very, very carefully. And nobody can predict what's going to happen. Yes.
I have a lot of things to say on this issue. My first feeling is that as I'm growing older and just learning about women in society, I was blinded before, but I think that just to touch on this a little bit, you know, there's sort of a propagandized, sort of a fake idea that women are in charge and, you know, they have all these powerful positions. But when you really break it down, it's really designed to treat women as consumers. It's just to get, you know, to use them as an economic unit rather than to empower them. And I feel my own rage at a lot of these things, how women and children and elderly people and minorities and almost everybody's treated so badly. I don't know where the root is. Like, where do you go? How do you fight it? Where's everybody's rage? I have mine. I don't see it anywhere else. Really, when you talk to people, it can come out, but it's like, where's the revolution? Especially with the Supreme Court, it's so delicate right now the way it is, and if they replace her with, you know, I mean, there goes women's right to choice, and when that's gone, you control half of the population. You take somebody's choice and their rights away, that's half of the population that's controlled. The blacks, the Latinos, they're in prison. There goes your empire. You know, it's like, this is a really, really important time for women to, my opinion, I recently heard a study that a couple of months ago, a chemistry professor told me about it, that women actually, I'm sorry, I'm going on and on, but I want people to know about this study, that it was done by scientists who discovered that women actually have like 300 more genes than men. And I'm not saying that, you know, that makes us superior. But like, my question is, if women are so much smarter and this and that, how come we've been taking it up the you-know-where for so long and without doing anything? I feel like responsible. I feel my responsibility as a woman to say, you know, I'm not going to take this. And I don't understand where it is with everybody else. Like, I mean, am I the only one? Where are people? Aside from NOW and the organizations that we've been hearing about, it's like there's a lot of you-know-what that's going to come down, I think, with the Bush administration and the treatment of everybody. And women, it's like Schwarzenegger's going after the nurses and teachers. These are misogynistic empire builders. And women and minorities are the first ones to feel it. So anyway, I'll finish with my rant.
a quick comment. Drawing from Zinn, so we have to remember sort of the two sides of this book, oppression and resistance. Just think of the California Nurses Association, one of the most militant unions in the country. One of the leaders of the California Nurses Association was on the executive council of the Labor Party when the Labor Party had its founding convention in 1996. In Cleveland, and I was at that convention, and I remain a member of the Labor Party, which is in pretty rough shape. But the nurses, an example of a group, strong contingent of women, and other groups, the literally thousands of women who have organized battered women's shelters. That is, there has been a rich tradition of resistance in the country. That's what Zinn is arguing, and it goes back and forth depending on the political and economic fortunes. And to sort of tie this with Roe v. Wade and the Supreme Court, if women are going to leave it up to the Supreme Court to guarantee their rights to control their bodies in this country, they'll be whistling Dixie. No fundamental change in this country has ever been led by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has reacted to profound changes, just as we talked a few months ago, without a human rights movement in the South, without World War II and vets coming back, there's no Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, without a women's movement and changes in this society, there's no Roe v. Wade 30 years ago. So who's on the Supreme Court, of course, is going to have a very powerful impact. But the changes in the country that women have brought about have come from the thousands and thousands of meetings, demonstrations, organization, legal struggles, classrooms, rallies, etc., not from the major political institutions in the country. And do not rely, I mean, I'm arguing this way, and I think Zinn would argue, do not rely on the Supreme Court or people like Sandra O'Connor, who's now being elevated as if she's some kind of saint. I mean, look at her career, okay? So all I'm saying is that we need to keep that in mind. There's a lot more going on also that we don't hear about in the mass media, in the US and in the world, that gives people hope. And that's what keeps people going, like yourself and others.
I wanted to go back to what the lady over here was saying about advertising. I'm studying in social science classes at Santa Monica College. Their professors are placing great emphasis in the books now on the impact of media on our minds, and especially the consumerism that the commercials foster that's gotten so extreme. I saw kind of a sad film of little girls, 7 or 8 years old, being interviewed and asked what they wanted to do with their life. And they were saying they wanted to be an astronaut or the president or a famous surgeon or an attorney. You know, they had great ambitions. You ask those same girls 5 years later, when 13 or 14, all they're talking about is boys. Their whole image of life has been greatly impacted by the commercials. They want to be pretty for the guys, and they're more worried about how pretty they are than anything else. And their weight, of course, and you get all the anorexia problems. So that is having a great impact on how women view, both women and girls, view themselves and view society. And it's at the root of much, I think, of these other problems we're talking about. Second thing I wanted to mention was the Log Cabin Republicans. I read a little bit of what they're saying about why they're still Republicans. And most of them say that they like Bush's position on other issues, so they were still voting for him. But now some of them are starting to rebel. They don't want to vote for this, you know, conservative stuff anymore.
I have a couple things to say. I feel real strongly about these issues, as I'm sure most of you do. And often wonder, where does this come from and how is it promulgated throughout society and history? It seems to me that as long as we think of and act in terms of dichotomies, we will only create more dichotomies. When we label men as in the superior position or in the power positions, or that what great gift it was for them to be in the power position so that most of them can die in the military, die in the factories, get used up in the coal mines and stuff. It was no great gift, this dichotomy. And it seems to me that it came from maybe when we moved from agrarian, interdependent cultures to more industrial, more power-oriented, hierarchical thinking that we've got now. And it seems to me that this is not going to change until we embrace the interrelationship of everybody where every position is valued. As far as young people today, from what my sons in college are telling me, young women are adopting the same values that we've called male values. You know, it's getting all blended into one big humanity of selfish, power-oriented, hierarchical thinking and full of dichotomies. I'm ready to move on from male, female, you know, anything that's one up or anything, and that we're all here together. And to me, that kind of paradigm shift will be at the root of hopefully leaving the atrocities behind us.
I'm thinking about the past few comments, people change, women change, seeming to change, and I'm starting to think that maybe what's going on is that even though women can go out and earn a living, economic times are more and more uncertain, and you're thinking, well, got to hook up, got to be with someone. I'm going to still go out and work an 80-hour work week, but that's not going to be enough, and my job's not guaranteed, my pension's not guaranteed. I mean, it's not a conscious thing that's necessarily filtering down to young women, but I think that's the climate. And, you know, and you can't discount sexuality, that's a whole thing, but I mean, growing up in the feminist movement, you can be free sexually, but not so defined by a man, but now it's more like, well, you know what, I better hook up, or because who knows if I'm gonna, you know, make a living down the road, or make enough of a living. That maybe that's what's happening. The economic uncertainty is creating a sort of a backwards trend in women's feelings, insecurity.
But the economic, I mean, the ebb and flow of the economy in this country, for better times, for worse times. I mean, think of the Great Depression and other periods of depression in the country. Those times have always been with us since the official founding of the country in 1776. Going back to Zinn again, with regard to the issue of gender, it would seem that it depends on how one assesses the nature of that society. There's no doubt that men's lives, in terms of working outside the home, in the mines, in other areas, men's lives were ground up by ruling class capitalists and just spit out, especially in areas like mining and in the steelwork, etc. Even though at times women broke into those areas. So it's how people assess that. And so that exploitation happened. But in terms of the feminist critique, one of the great tragedies is often, far too often, the men came home from the coal mines and from the steel mills and from driving a bus, et cetera, to take out the incredible anger and frustration and violence on women. I mean, one of the keys of this society is to always be able to have your foot on someone's neck. And in terms of gender, we know, for the most part, what that has been. And you see it manifest in so many tragic examples of violence against women. At times, people came together to see that what men had to do in the mines and the steel mills was damaging, harmful to their bodies and their spirits. And there were struggles by men and women. Those times have actually been rare, even in labor union struggles, where especially the American Federation of Labor, unlike the Industrial Workers of the World and the CIO at times in the 1930s, deliberately kept women out. And so the vision of we are men, we are male, and we are female both is the vision that you articulated eloquently. The reality has been to organize us against that and to continue the ranking, the division, that is, it is harmful ultimately to both of us. There's no doubt about that.
Hi. I just thought it's interesting that so few men are here tonight when we usually have a more balanced participation. Yeah. And also, it really would be nice to hear an additional male voice beside yours, John, tonight. But anyhow. I just wanted to say, Teresa, that people here seem to be paralyzed or hypnotized, but people in the women in Bolivia and in Nigeria and in Venezuela are doing some great work. I think in Nigeria, the women organized to kick out whatever oil company it was. Yeah, whatever it was. In Bolivia, they're doing some incredible things Venezuela. So, yeah. Well, yeah, the women are really doing incredible things all over the world. I have a feeling there are stirrings of things going on here too, but I hope you're not disheartened and that you want to work.
I think that the right wing, the Republican Party, are very sophisticated in taking a good positive word and turning it into something that's bad. For example, years ago when they talked about progressive education in California, all of a sudden progressive became a dirty word. And I think the same thing has happened with the word feminist. And I think it came from two places. I think it was part of that political spectrum that's able to take something good and turn it into something that everybody will be against. And I think that's part of why people today back off of saying, well, I'm a feminist. In addition to that, there's also particularly the Catholic Church that has come out and spoken out very strongly about the horrible thing of feminist. So I think there's two very strong elements there. Again, it's from the Christian angle, but I think also from the political thing. I have noticed in places where I work that where professional men have to interact with professional women, they have a very difficult time doing that. They don't see themselves as misogynistic or anything. They think that they're very equitable. But even you can look in a staff meeting, and the men will be talking, and a professional woman will say something, and they'll just ignore her, unless she's somebody like Margaret Thatcher. Those kinds of qualities. The same way if walking down the hall and there's males and females, the males will acknowledge each other and will say nothing to the females. If two females are talking, the male will butt right in, stop their conversation, and do what they want to do. If there's a couple of men talking and the woman comes up, she can just wait until they're finished. And these are people who are professional people, and they say that they appreciate professional women, but it doesn't show out. It doesn't show in the behavior. And women were controlled, I think, by this concept of feminism being used in a very negative way. I think politically it kind of squelched the activity that was there.
And it's understandable why that was done, because let's not mince any words. If the thrust, the essence of the issues that feminists raised about equality in a whole different spheres were to come about, the other gender, right, males, would have to lose power. That does not mean that the way Malcolm X phrased it about racism, the United States, he said, was a racist society. That didn't mean every single individual white was racist. Make the same argument about sexism. that institutionally this society is sexist from top to bottom, from side to side, and all of us, as males especially, but not just males, because the key to maintaining hegemony or influence over people is to get the subordinate group to also swallow some of these issues in the church and in schools, etc. So we just, you sort of breathe it in. It's not that I had to take a particular class in school in which you learned, the teacher said, now remember, when you get a job and you and another guy are talking and a woman comes, just ignore her. No, but it just, you know, it remember, because we're formally a free and equal society. That's why it's far more difficult to understand how things happen in this society than if you were at the time of the Inquisition with kings and a few queens, and when the church was totally dominant. The Roman Catholic Church is not as dominant as it was centuries ago, certainly not in Western Europe, okay, and not even in the United States, even though it's certainly quite powerful. So we got to keep in mind that things have happened. But if in this domination and subordination, the subordinate group is to throw the shackles off and to struggle and to gain more power, somebody's got to lose power. This is not a win-win situation. If women are not making the same as men, and you live in a society, where are we going to get these resources? If you equalize pay, if you do this and that, well, these resources are going to have to come from someplace. If men totally dominate educational institutions, corporations, etc., and more women then take their positions in those institutions, well, if the institutions are not growing, proportionally people are going to lose things. And so I think men actually, and not just those in power, understand that. Because this is the fundamental struggle, I think, as deep and as pervasive and as far more violent and volatile to the history of the country, racism is much more fundamental to the nature of human being, and you touched on it, is the relationship between males and females in terms of how we're raised, what is right, what is wrong, what we respect, what we don't respect. And every single institution that we've grown up in, starting from the family, we learned it. We learned it. No way to avoid it.
Well, I think that women have to start and take control of their own destiny. Because if you look at history, you see there really hasn't been a lot of change, at least not economically. And I think each and every one of us women, we're not going to get the help from Washington. We're not going to get it from a government structure. We're probably not going to get it from a textbook. That we each have to make a stand, and we have to be willing to put down some ideas that we have about being feminine. If we, you know, we can't have it both ways. And it begins in the pocketbook. I remember my grandfather once told me everything boils down to economics, and I thought he was really an old fogey. But the older I've gotten, I think back on that, and I think how true. We women have a habit of wanting it both ways. We want our fancy ball gowns, and we want the guy to hold the door, and we want the guy to pay the bill, and yet, you know, we don't want to maybe work as hard, or we're not willing to be courageous. We have to be willing to stand out in the rain and do the heavy stuff, the stinky stuff. And we can't have it both ways. And we have to start and be courageous and find within ourselves, and I'm not sure what that is either, but something tells me we women need to redefine, and we need to be true revolutionaries prepared to die for our cause and what we are. And if we're not prepared to die for it, revolution will never happen. And we've got to be willing to take ourselves out there and put ourselves on the line. And we have to go, each one of us, go within and say, what is it for me to be me? Which is more important to me, to be a woman or to be a human being? I'm a filmmaker and a writer and an author. And when people say, what's it like to do women's films? What's it like to be a woman's director? I say, I don't know. I'm not a woman's director. I don't make women's films. I make films for audiences. I write books for people. And if we keep going on this dichotomy, I don't think we're ever going to get anywhere. So I urge each and every one of us, and myself included, to sit down sometime and say, what is it to be me? What am I? Will I only continue to define myself by my genitalia? And do I still have to do my nails and you know, fluff up my hair and put on perfume and make sure my genitals are clean and I smell like a girl? Are we willing to go out there and do the work? Because I know a lot of times, like when I'm working in a production, women come to me and say, oh, I want to help you, I want to work. But they won't work 18 hours on their feet in the rain, in the cold. Only the men back me up in that. And this is what bothers me. We women have to be willing to do the dirty stuff and do the hard work. We can't have it both ways. We can't have the soft life. We can't have a guy taking care of us, paying half the bills. We've got to be willing to get the economics in our hip pocket. And if we don't have the money, if we don't have productivity, I think that's where it starts for whether you're young or old. You've got to have the buying power. Because that's the way they're defining power in Washington. Everything boils down to bucks. And it starts for females by redefining yourself as a productive unit who can earn money, and then you don't need men to pay the bill. Thank you.
Of course, just a quick comment from Zinn. If we look back at his, not just his work, but some of the other works on the suggested reading list, women do not have to reinvent the wheel. That if you can go back to any period in U.S. history, whether it be the mid-19th century with Stanton and Mott, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, etc., you can come up to the more modern movement leading up to the vote in 1920 and think of some of the struggles in England, even more so than the United States. Think of the international struggles now in Bolivia, in Venezuela, etc., that all these things have been done. They've been written about. Some of them have been filmed, as you know. And so it's not a question of women here in the United States and men who wish to be allies having to invent something. The history is already there. There's just plenty of marvelous works about what has happened, and of course, what has not happened, the struggles for women to gain equality in the workplace, turn back over and over and over again. As I said, one of the, you know, think of the union movement in the United States. I mean, I'm a union member and grew up in a union family, but the record of the American Federation of Labor especially has been absolutely despicable in terms of helping women gain equality in the workplace. So
I say it has to come from each individual female now, because nobody's going to help us. And I guess I didn't say it very well, because I don't know how to define courage, and that's what we women have to find. We have to find the courage to die for what we believe in, and I don't know if most women will do that.
Well, I don't know if most people.
Until we're willing to die for our beliefs, we're not going to have strength. And we have to find the courage as an individual to go out there and break away, maybe even from unions, because they haven't always helped us. We got to be able to start our own business. If somebody's not paying us right, we've got to have the courage to move out and go into something else, move away and create our own thing, become our own productive unit. That's all I'm saying. I'm not very well educated about women's history, and there's a lot of things I don't know. That's why I came. I want to learn. But something, an animal streetwise instinct tells me that each one of us has to find something within us that's strong, and nobody else is going to help us but ourselves.
Right. But again, going back to Zinn, that individual strand has to be connected to other women. There is no individual liberation for women in this society. There are individual choices and maneuverings and possibilities to make life better for some women. But what he's discussing, and what at least I see in the history of the struggle for equality in the United States, is it's a social movement. It's a collective movement. And that's why I find, for example, I don't get moved whatsoever that, wow, Madeleine Albright became Secretary of State, given what her role was in articulating U.S. policy in the world. I'm not overwhelmed by the fact that Perhaps the most powerful woman in this society is Oprah Winfrey, who's on the Forbes list of the top 100 or 200 wealthiest people worth roughly $400 million, who bought herself a $50 million mansion in Montecito, California, right up the road from here, when there are both black and white women living in boxes not far from where she has her house, or living here in California. So the success of individuals is important only up to a certain point, because this is a movement of females, plural, women, plural, not some women. That's the key to the feminist movement, that unless all women can be safe and secure in their homes, alone or with someone else, male or female, can have the same respect and pay at work, can be able to breathe fresh air, et cetera, unless all women have that, some women having it and others not having it is not enough. That's part of what he's arguing about the woman's movement.
I still think it starts within each woman, though.
Okay.
Earlier in the evening, in the beginning of your lecture, you said that something to the effect that those in power won't relinquish their power to those seeking power. Is that about the gist of it?
Yeah, I think U.S. history is absolutely rife with examples of that.
And still, by 1920, we gave women the right to vote with a constitutional amendment. But it seems to me that, from what I understand from that period, that was a very sexist, racist, chauvinistic period. And it kind of baffles me why men would relinquish their power at that time to women, which is would make more sense to me that this would come about 40 years later during the Civil Rights era. And what do you think was happening in the environment there that men finally gave in and gave women the right to vote?
Well, they didn't give, men have never given women anything. Women struggle for, that movement started, let's say, formally, if you want to date it.
In 1848. Right.
It started before that, of course, and then seemed to subside. And a number of creative historical arguments have made the claim in terms of the national right to vote that was in the constitutional amendment in 1920, that one of the reasons, sadly to say, is that white women who were leaders in the feminist movement, in the suffragette movement would be more accurate, in many ways they may not have been feminists, argued, as they did in the 1860s and 70s, that they should have the vote in order to offset the vote of the hordes of immigrants coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, Eastern European Jews, Poles, Sicilians, and Greeks. And there are a number of historians, not just women, of course, other historians as well, who argue that that press of millions, tens of millions of immigrants coming to the country, that the argument then was seen as a way to offset their political power by allowing women to vote, because the women overall were going to be more conservative when it came to social, political, and economic power.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about the effects of World War I? This was 2 years after World War I. Did that have a factor in it?
I'm not sure how the war, of the works that I just finished a whole series of books on immigration that only touched tangentially on the women's question. But I haven't seen any arguments about how the war affected the right to vote. I mean, I'm sure they're out there. I just am not aware of them.
Okay.
I think that one of the other factors in it was what we are now considering anti-feminist, that when the idea was promoted then that women should be voting and should be in positions of influence because they were more moral and they were needed to control the animality of men.
Yeah, that is one of the arguments. Women, in a sense, I think the term is women are the char women of the industrial age. They clean up the mess, and you are as a group more moral, more pure, especially than those scruffy immigrants coming who don't even speak the language, as opposed to, and they really were talking about white women here, not black women. And so women, and of course the whole strand of the progressive movement in which women get involved in the settlement house movement, Jane Addams, etc., that the women are going to change the conditions, not just of men, by the way, but of immigrant women who came, especially think of the immigration patterns at that time, were dramatically skewed toward women and men from Southern and Eastern Europe. Jews escaping the pogroms in Russia and in Poland, Italians and Sicilians, which were the largest group in the period 1890 to 1924, when the immigration was shut down virtually. I mean, there was just a trickle then from Southern and Eastern Europe. But all sorts of the stereotypes about these immigrant families and the progressives and the liberals in the social welfare movement are going to take care of this, and they're going to be women, because, and same way with the whole arguments about women making better teachers of young children than men. When we go back to that cult of true womanhood in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, that is the early rise of the common school period in the United States, when the teaching force, they aim to get more and more young women to teach children, which was not the case in the United States. Before we had a mass educational system, often the teachers of young children were ministers and were men. So the whole ideology changes, that you're going to straighten this whole thing out. Imagine having that burden. We'll let Curtis, you can have the final word.
It's actually just a query. It's just kind of a question. You know, this is complicated stuff in terms of how all this, how do you break this stuff? How do you break this cycle with so many, you know, if we were in a setting where people felt safe enough to share with each other, I mean, really safe, or in any group, and if you ask women, primarily in a group, how many had been abused as kids in some way? A lot, a whole lot, and kind of across economic, racial, this is really deep stuff about how do you change these feelings of people, of us when we're kids, in a sense of our own personal empowerment, like, what is my role in this world, and do I need to assume a subservient place or not? But the query, the question, I guess, I'm thinking this whole time is that, you know, John, you mentioned, and this is, I'm sure, how most of us see the world presently, is that it's a limited pie, and if you take more of the pie than I have, then I'm going to fight you for it because it's a fixed amount, and anyone's gain is someone else's loss. But I'm just wondering, in each of us, growing up, men and women, as individuals, what would it take for us to become adults with the idea that someone else's hurt or loss also diminishes us? You know, what would it really take for us to get to that point? Because unless we do, and I get the idea that Zinn's argument, and I think it's really true, more than I really grasp, the need for group resistance, not simply individual, but start, obviously, as the lady said back there, starting with the individual. But, you know, when is enough going to be enough on all these levels of personal violence and all these, you know, what is it going to take individually for us, each one, to get to the point where if I'm a man and if I have the luxury maybe of strength or muscle or self-inflated self-esteem that I can express my frustration living in a property-based competitive society, I can take that out on someone else, and that may not change. You know, so what's it going to do for a man? What's it going to take for a man to get to the point that not only is it wrong, but it actually hurts me to do that?
Well, why don't we leave with those profound questions? Thank you.
You have been listening to Dr. John Marciano's discussion group as they considered Chapter 6 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, called The Intimately Oppressed. The group met on July 12th of 2005. Every month, a group led by Dr. Marciano meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.